Welcome to A Kenyan's Experience, a podcast for Kenyans by Kenyans. In this podcast, we use real, raw, and personal journeys to provide you with the knowledge and the power to demystify, simplify, and make better decisions about your academic and professional future. They say experience is the best teacher. Well, here you'll hear about the experiences of Kenyan nationals who navigated the academic and professional worlds, both locally in Kenya and in the diaspora. This podcast is relevant for everyone at any point in their academic or career path, from high schoolers to university students to industry professionals, and even those looking to pivot later in their careers. Here at A Kenyan's Experience, we ask the questions you wish you had answers to before you started your academic or professional journey, before you made that life-changing big decision. And we normalize making bold decisions for you. So tune in for a once-weekly episode that will leave you inspired, challenged, and laughing as Kenyans tell their stories here on A Kenyan's Experience.
Back to another episode of A Kenyan's Experience. Today I'm joined with my lovely co-host Dennis.
Hey guys, happy to be back for another episode.
So this, like Dennis was just saying, we've been bringing back everyone from our childhood. So we've racked up everyone from adulting and now we're going back to way, way back. And today I'm joined by none other than who everyone used to think was my older sister, Shiro Washiro, my twin. I know Shiro from St. Austin's. I think I've known her my whole life, I think. Literally, me and her younger brother, gosh, people used to think that me and Mina were literally twins. Especially when my parents cut my hair, they're like, are you guys twins? Are you a boy, Cynthia? I'm like, my name is Cynthia, so no. So we've known each other for maybe 25, 24 years. So very, very long time. So welcome to the podcast, Shiro. Very, very happy to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. Definitely feeling a little bit of imposter syndrome being asked to be interviewed for anything, but excited to be here.
So we'll kick it off as we normally do. So who is Shiro Washiro?
I say this to you already, but no matter how many times I get that question, it triggers a massive existential crisis. But I guess I would say I am an activist at heart with the mind and spirit of a classic type A personality, or like older, eldest African daughter personality, whatever you want to call it. A lot of my friends would describe me as a very granola black girl with many passions and few obsessions. Wow. So I love to write. I love thinking and talking about sustainable farming. I love to decorate my house, very boho interior chic style. So those are sort of the things that plug together, make something of a personality.
I love that description of yourself. Yeah.
I'm trying really hard to not describe myself with what I do anymore, but it's proving very challenging. I don't know if either of you struggle with that.
My gosh, I've always described myself starting with what I do. Mm-hmm. And then a friend of mine told me, so if you actually take that away from you, how would you answer that question? And I boosted. Yeah. I literally just froze. I didn't know. So you've done very well. Yeah, it's a really good introduction.
Yeah, no, I think it's really important if we're sort of, we'll get into this, I'm sure, later, but if you want to work sustainably and build a sustainable career, I think it's really important to begin to self-identify outside of what you do.
100%. And I think I would agree, especially as a doctor, because I think a lot of people, like, we're just starting this little conversation with Shiro. She was just like, how do you have time for anything other than medicine? I just bring back this conversation. It's because I have to. Otherwise, because you never know what could happen tomorrow. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't know, with AI, will there be an AI doctor? Who knows? Especially with NHS, they can't be trusted. So, yeah, so I think it's definitely very important. But I mean, unfortunately, this podcast is also about career, so we will have to delve into that. And you described yourself as an activist. So how would you describe what you do exactly right now?
I'm not an activist right now. And don't get me wrong, I am very passionate about my career and I love it. But, you know, trying to be a well-rounded individual. So right now, in general, I am passionate about democratizing opportunity. And that's what I'd say is the organizing principle of the professional opportunities I've pursued. And it really energizes me to support other people and communities in achieving their goals. Right now, what that looks like is I'm working on a social enterprise called Growing Acres, which is an apprenticeship-based skills program for agricultural workers. It's a bit of a mouthful. but we aim to equip our apprentices with the knowledge, the mindset, and the access to innovation and technology that they need to run profitable farms in Kenya for now. But our ambition is to work across Africa.
What got you into that? What was the beginning? Was that an interest from early on?
Yeah. So agriculture has not always been an interest. And so this is the connection with the activist identity. But I think social mobility has always been something I'm really passionate about. Mm-hmm. I think many Kenyans our age can tell a story of grandparents or parents who grew up in very different socioeconomic conditions than we've lived our lives. And growing up, I was always acutely aware of how a lot of the pathways that existed because of social policy, because of progressive social policy, because of different types of community support, the pathways that existed to allow prior generations to, you know, progress out of poverty over time have changed a lot. And I don't think that we have quite reckoned with what that means at a society-wide level. And I think we still have a lot to do in terms of dreaming and imagining more equitable social structures for 21st century Africa. And so I think that's sort of the organizing sort of idea in how I've thought about my career. When I was at university, and I know we'll talk a little bit more about this, but when I was at university, I lived in Chicago, which is sort of the home of political organizing in so many ways, and especially Black political organizing. So it just allowed, I think, this interest in economic justice to really flower and grow. And I think really embed in my spirit as the thing that's sort of most important to me. So when I made the decision to move back home, and I was thinking about what does it mean to work in social justice, agriculture felt like, in a lot of ways, a no-brainer. I know 60% of Africans rely on agriculture for their livelihoods in some form or another. And most of the world's rural poor is in Africa, and most of them are engaged in agriculture. So that's kind of what brought me to agriculture, and then specifically focusing on human capital and talent is sort of a different and convoluted story, but it sort of goes back to this idea of, like, how can we create systems that allow people to achieve their goals and be, you know, whatever their version of their best self is? Like, how do we sort of democratize the opportunity to dream in that way?
That's a very, I don't know, what, Dennis, do you have a response to that? That's incredible.
It's a very agricultural response.
And looking back at, you know, primary school, Shiro, was there a moment when you were younger with your parents, you know, relatives, people, teachers, mentors, was there a time when you felt like even the slight tinge or slight pull to be like, this is something that I would be interested in? Because I know you mentioned Chicago. Was there any time before that when you were in Kenya where you felt that encouragement to be an activist, to fight for other people's rights and just encourage them?
You know, I think I was lucky growing up. My parents in different ways, but both of them, I think, were very principle first people. And my brother and I were really raised with a belief that we owe society something. And I think both my parents, in the way they shaped their careers and the way they sort of instilled values in us, really taught us that it's important to do the right thing, even if no one ever knows you did it. And they both really dedicated a lot of their careers to service. And I've seen both my parents turn down opportunities to make more money or build wealth to pursue things that they thought were better for their community, whatever sort of scope that took at different stages in their life and career. I don't always think that it's a trade-off between, you know, achieving certain types of material success and doing the right thing, but I think it often is, unfortunately. And so I felt very lucky to grow up with that ethos, I think, shaping a lot of the ways decisions were made in our house.
Yeah, so from that background, from primary school, now even going into secondary school, were there any other things, any other subjects that tempted you, any other interests that were there as well?
Yeah, and that's a good question. I feel like I've always, I mean, the sort of positive way to put it is I am a generalist through and through, but at various points when I've you know, been in career crisis, I've often wondered, will I ever know what I want to do? So I think my passion, it's taken me a long time to even see the through line in the types of things I've been interested in and passionate about. I've always loved learning and loved connecting with different types of people. So I think I've chased opportunities to do that and broaden my horizons as much as I can. You know, there's a point I wanted to run, when I think about like what iterations my career ambitions took, there's a point I wanted to run a chain of eco hotels. And in my preteen brain, that was a perfect combination of doing something for the world and connecting with people and hosting people, which has always been, you know, something that has given me a lot of joy. But no, I think, and there was a point in my life I wanted to be a lawyer, but I think sometimes, and particularly if you sort of come from a family background that has a more traditional view on careers, sometimes when we're in school, we don't really have a good understanding of how broad our professional horizons might be. And I would say for a lot of my friends and I now, I don't think we could describe our careers to younger us. Like, we didn't have the language to understand what it means to like build a career in general social entrepreneurship or to build a career as a consultant. And I think that it's exciting that we have been able to take a more, a less structured, a more sort of innovative and bespoke approach to building our careers.
And would you say that because you didn't have a more traditional approach to thinking about your career, or rather you didn't have the language, like you said, to describe what exactly that you wanted to, but you knew in your heart there was something that you wanted to do. Was that what led you to go to university or to college in the States, and particularly Chicago? Or was there an opportunity, or was there a time where you looked at, oh, maybe University of Nairobi or JKUAT? Or did you just feel like the Nairobi sort of like university system and structure just wouldn't give you? Because whenever I think of people who want to, you know, be in social entrepreneurship, I always think lawyer. You know, those are the first person you think of in Kenya. Like that's the only way you can fight for other people. It's very difficult to do it otherwise. And so is that what led you to going to Chicago?
Yeah, and it's a good question. And, you know, for better or for worse, and I think this conversation, it's interesting now that I'm at an age where my friends are starting to have kids and ask themselves these questions about where do I send my kid to school? So for better or for worse, my parents, and in particular my dad, really wanted us to go to school abroad. Partly they, you know, came from a time where there was a very one-to-one return on your education investments. And sort of the more degrees you had and the fancier the school associated with that degree, the more money you were going to make. I'm not saying that's completely untrue now, but I think it's changed dramatically. But from when I was 8 years old and my brother was six, the message was, you guys are going to Harvard or you're going to Oxford. Those are the two options.
Wow.
So the bar was always like sky high. And so I have to say, I never even considered the possibility of going to school locally. And I think, and then I was in British system schools my whole time in school. So I think I would be giving myself unfair credit to say that it was more thought up than that. And then thinking about the UK versus the US, I, as I said, I've always been a generalist, and loving to learn has always been really important to me. And so I was very attracted to the liberal arts education approach, which is way more prominent in the US than it is anywhere else in the world. And for folks who might be unfamiliar, basically liberal arts schools take a general arts and sciences approach to your education. So rather than focusing on vocational or professional skills, they really teach you to be a broad and adaptive learner. I think the selling pitch is usually, we teach you how to think. And that resonated with me, and I really wanted that. And so the US ended up being a way more appealing opportunity.
So how did you navigate towards that, especially being in a whole British system high school lifestyle? And I'm sure British system schools, they drill in, you know, you're going to the UK, here many UK universities, here so-and-so mm-hmm. coming from the UK to talk to you about such and such. And then they mention very little about either US universities, local universities, yeah. or any other universities. So how did you navigate away from that and decide, okay, boom, Chicago?
Yeah, that's very true. So we were actually only four or five of us in my graduating high school class that even applied anywhere in the US. And so we were teaching our guidance counselor how to fill out the common application. It was definitely like we had to figure it all out. But those of us who did want to go that path were very clear-eyed that we sort of had this goal. It helps that, you know, when you look at top 10, 15 schools in the world, that's very dominated by US schools. And so that was like, you know, sort of incentivized us to try and aim big. In terms of the specific programs, I think US universities do an excellent job at marketing, and each of them tell a story about who they are and what their personality is. I think many of us who've gone to school in the US will question how true that experience is once you're actually there. But one of the things that really appealed to me about UChicago, which at least while I was there felt true, is they had the slogan, Life of the Mind. So they were a school that really promoted, we value knowledge for its own sake as an end in and of itself. It's known as a very nerdy school where fun goes to die is another slogan for the school.
Wow.
And at the time, I thought I wanted to study economics, and its economics department in particular is sort of world-renowned. World-renowned from a point of view I now very, very strongly disagree with, but I sort of needed to go to understand how much I disagreed with the Chicago School of Economics. So that's kind of what drew me there. And they had the quirkiest like essay questions in my year. You know, there was a question that was like, there are two types of people in the world, those who love tomatoes and those who hate tomatoes. And they had a couple of other examples like that. And they were like, what are the two types of people you think they are? Every year there's a question that's just find X. That's a whole essay prompt. You know, so that really appealed to me. And I liked the sort of like quirkier, sort of like hyper-intellectual approach to education.
And what was it like to sell that to your parents? Because, I mean, they clearly had, they sound very open-minded, but they also sound like they had a structure for you guys from a young age. And so what was it like selling to them? Like, hey, I'm going to go thousands of miles away and I don't really know what I'm going to study. But I'm going to study how to study, but you're going to pay for it. So what was that like explaining that to them? And just, I think especially with African parents sort of, I mean, probably your parents weren't like this, but sort of just they need to know what the end point is. It's like, you're going to do this, so you're going to end up here. But obviously, if you study such a generalized degree, then that has to be a number two. But then at that point, you don't know what number two is. And it's just a massive question mark. So what was it like discussing that with them? And I guess also, what's it like explaining to them now what it is that you do?
That's a great question. I was lucky. My brother and I were lucky. Our parents were fully on board. For different reasons. My mom was forced into her career. So she was, you know, a good student So she was a good student. And so everyone said, you have to go into medicine. Like, that's what good students do. And so she went to medical school. She became a dentist and practiced for a year. And she was like, I absolutely hate this. So she went to school to get her MBA and then became an accountant. and so she had lived what it was like to be forced into a career. And as a result, was always like, you guys will figure out what you want to do. Go forth. I believe in you. and my dad is like a super hyper intellectual as well. So he loved everything about UChicago. He loved the approach to education. He loved the life of the mind philosophy. And he also loved the prestige of the school. So I think more than anything, that probably sold him. So yeah.
Decided if it's not Harvard, and then the second might as well be.
You know, he was disappointed that I didn't even apply to Harvard. but yeah, and then in terms of do they know what I do now? No. My mom has never been able to accurately describe my job. And as I remember when I first moved back after college, she'd just like look at me, go to the office, and she was like, are you going to work? Like, why are you dressed like that? I should hear me on work calls. And she's like, who are you talking to like that? You're not friends. That's your boss, you know? So she's like, definitely a different generation in terms of like work norms. And yeah.
That's funny. I go through exactly the same thing because my yeah. parents were very supportive of me going to the UK. So I did gaming, a computer game enterprise. So they're like, oh yeah, let him do what he wants to do. I mean, he'll find his way eventually. And then now, you know, I come back here and then actually do work in gaming. My parents still have no idea what it is that I do. Anything IT related.
You...
Like, yeah, he fixes computers and like, that's not what I do.
That's not what I do.
It's so funny because even more traditional careers, like one of my really good friends is an electrical engineer, and every time he goes home, his mom is like, can you fix this light for me? And he's yeah. like, no, that's not what I do.
I do.
I really can't.
And I can imagine Dennis as well, because you work from home quite a bit. You're only in the office like once a week. Your parents are like, so we took you to school for you to spend the time
exactly.
at home.
Exactly. Like, they have no idea. Like, this guy is not working. He's just at home talking to his computer. Yeah, we have no idea what he's doing.
I feel like especially because you're in gaming also, it's extra. Like,
oh, man, yeah.
Extra
yeah,
sass.
Just, extra sass. Like, you just continue playing these games, huh? Okay.
That's really funny.
And so you mentioned going to the States and sort of expectations not meeting reality. Can you tell us a bit more about that? I think particularly because we've not had a lot of people who studied in the States be on this podcast. Yeah. I think it would be quite interesting. I think there's a lot of obviously racial dynamics to that question, mm-hmm. but also there's mm-hmm. just the social dynamics of it and just understanding what it's like as a Kenyan going abroad to the States.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I think, you know, because I think each part of the country has such a different culture, I think there will be so many different takes on this. But just to contextualize what UChicago was when I got there, there were 4 Africans in my year of 1,500 students. So there wasn't a natural community, or 4 Africans who grew up in Africa, I should say. There were a few folks whose parents were African, but they were born and raised in the US. So there wasn't like a natural community to find that looked like me. But Chicago is home to this like rich cultural, political history, and this extremely rich and proud Black community in the US. So it's a really interesting place to confront your racial identity as a Black person coming from Africa in the US. I have a lot of problems with the narrative that you discover your race when you leave the continent, because I think it flattens a lot of the ways we learn to aspire to whiteness. And that's a whole other political conversation. But caveating that, I do think, like, living in Chicago taught me how to be proud to be Black and how to talk about race and identity candidly, but in a way that didn't, you know, make it the sort of only organizing principle of your politics. So I was very lucky in that sense. And I got extremely involved in political organizing while I was there, first on a healthcare justice campaign. And then I went to school 2012 to 2016. So Black Lives Matter was born while I was in college. And I joined a movement for Black Lives group. It wasn't BLM, the organization, but it was part of the wider movement. And so I think that gave me a home in a way in the US that I think that sometimes it's easier not to, like, you know, you can sort of say those Black people's problems are their problems. We have our own problems. And there's a way we can be a bit tribal even within a global Black community. Yeah. And I think, at least for me, it really enriched my worldview to sort of see, like, I want to work in solidarity with sort of the political organizing that was happening there. So that was kind of outside of school. But at school, you know, I think ways it didn't live up to the reality. One is, you know, this sort of idea of where fun comes to die seemed fun and quirky on the outside. But being on the inside, I realized actually what it means is, it's a high pressure environment where you glorify burnout, you glorify mm-hmm. depression and misery and being stressed and at an overcapacity. Like, the American college experience is all consuming. the residential life is very, like, your world is your college for the most part. I think it's different for people who go to school, like, smack bang in the middle of New York or something. But for the most part, your life, especially in college as an undergrad, is really oriented around the university. And so in a way that, like, when I looked at my friends in the UK, they were, you know, building community with Kenyans across the country, not just on their campus. And they had more of a life outside of campus. And so it can be hard to resist the culture of your institution. And certainly at UChicago, we were always, like, it was the busyness Olympics. You know, you'd be in the library at 2 a.m. and you're rattling off how many more things you have to do and how you're going to have to pull an all-nighter. There was a sense of pride in it. And, you know, as I spent more time as a student and began to see the toll it was taking on people, it sort of cemented something in me now that I'm super passionate about still, which is, like, don't glorify killing yourself to produce. Like, we are more than our accomplishments and the pieces of paper we carry. And that can be hard in an African context to truly preach. And I know it can sound hypocritical for someone who, like, a good older daughter or eldest African daughter, I have all my papers and stamps. So I know that it can sort of be like, well, that's all good for you to say, but you did it. You know, you, like, went to the prestigious schools and you got your master's and you did all of that. But I think really building a social community that allows you to escape the pressure to like always be your achievements is really important in life in general. But if you go to university in the US and especially certain schools, it's really important to find that early.
And were there any moments where you felt that you sort of needed to take a break? I mean, talking about burnout, I think a lot more people are more open-minded to talking about burnout, talking about being overwhelmed and sort of like drawing that boundary and that barrier between themselves and their accomplishments, like you've said. Was there a moment yeah. for you where you were sort of like, because we started this conversation talking about not defining ourselves by what we do, because what we do is an yeah. accomplishment, right? And so was yeah. there a moment in university where you were just like, either when you're doing your undergrad or your master's, was there a moment you were just like, actually, yeah. this isn't it for me?
Yeah, not in undergrad, but when I was doing my master's, for sure. I think in undergrad, I just didn't feel like there was an otherwise. Like, I just didn't know what else I would do but get the degree. And so I sort of kept pushing for that reason. And it didn't feel like an option not to finish. And in part, it was because, you know, like, we've always been comfortable growing up, but we never came from a wealthy family. So I didn't feel like if I stopped, you know, there'd be like this comfortable life where I'd have an allowance and, you know, could be at home and taken care of. So it just felt like I had to be head down and go through it. But my master's was weirdly even harder. I was talking to a friend about this yesterday, and we were saying, I think part of it is just like, it's harder to build community when you're older. People go, fewer people go straight through to their master's in the US than the UK. So I've taken 5 years between the two. And by that time, you know, people are coming back with fiancés or married or kids or just like busier, fuller lives outside of the program. And yeah, it's a shorter program. So I think there's less of an opportunity to build community. And I went to a school that I think was just not the right fit for me. So I ended up having a really, really miserable time. I was pretty severely depressed. I like to be honest about, you know, mental health and, you know, showing the ugly side of visible success, because I think we don't talk enough about that, especially in Kenya. And so I nearly quit. And I think I only finished it again because sometimes we can have this like internal pressure coming from these communities of like, I don't want to fail. And I need to sort of just like get the accreditations and the stamps. And in the midst of it, I just didn't feel like, again, there was really an otherwise. And some of it, some of the dynamics changed. Like I knew that if I had stopped grad school, I'd still be able to go and find a job. And the stakes were slightly lower from that perspective. But I also knew as a Black African woman, people are less likely to think I made an empowered decision and more likely to think I couldn't hack it. You know, like Stanford was just too hard for me.
So two questions. One will lead into the other. With American colleges and universities, did you get the chance to come home, like say over the holidays, over the Easter break, over Christmas break?
Yeah. As an undergrad, I didn't as much, but grad school, again, the beauty of working between your two degrees is you have savings and yeah, you can support yourself. So for grad school, I had a lot more flexibility. I was home so much. I remember one of my friend's parents was like, did you leave? I feel like I've seen you every 3 months. So that was a very different experience. But undergrad, no, I came back, I think, twice or three times in the 4 years. And one time it was because I got funding from the university to do an internship here over the summer.
Yeah, so coming back and then now seeing the friends who are in UK universities, and of course they've built cultures and they've built friendships and societies in completely different ways than you have.
Yeah.
Did that ever get to you, especially them being very close friends and you being miles away in a completely different culture?
No, it was hard moving, especially when I finally did move back. So I moved back in 2017 after I graduated. I worked for a year in New York and then I moved back. And it was really isolating. I was like, all these people know each other and they've built this community and they always, you know, I see them on Instagram together and they just like, there's a natural sort of synergy there. And there's also sort of like a trauma that I felt like so many of us who went to the US had, but the folks who went to the UK didn't have. And of course, it fades over time. So now nearly 30 or with some of my friends in their 30s, it doesn't feel as salient anymore, but it felt very prominent when I first moved back. So moving back, you know, I got lucky about the timing I moved back. And I think a lot of people who've lived in Nairobi over the last 10 years will have seen a difference in the type of expat that comes to the country. But I feel like as I was moving back, there's a sort of wave of young Black expats from the US coming at that point. And so at some point, someone added me to a group that was Black expats and repats. So those of us who'd gone to school in the US. And that became my core community for the first couple of years when I moved back, as I sort of reintegrated into my high school networks and sort of remade my friends.
I didn't know repats was a term, actually.
It's a thing. I feel like it's such a cultural thing. Repat from wherever. Like there is a moment where like, and the pejorative version is the summer bunny energy, but I think there's a genuine shock. there's a lot of, that's annoying about summer bunny energy, but you know, I do think there's something real about like, it just takes a minute to like build your life as an adult here. Because the reality is you're also for the first time coming into adulthood in Kenya, right? Exactly. Like Yeah, and that takes time to get used to.
Yeah, I think I definitely resonate with what you said before about when we were just talking about drawing that line and having that moment where you sort of have to sit with yourself and just be like, what is actually defining me in this moment? I remember mine was, unfortunately, in my final year of medical school, after it had taken me, you know, 7.5 years or so to finally get to that point where I'm about to, you know, become a doctor on paper anyways. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, actually, because what was on the line was essentially, if I keep pushing myself, I could work just hard enough so that I could graduate with honors, which is pretty hard to do from a medical school perspective. But then I was just like, you know what? And I'm going to start, but fuck this. I was like, my mental health is just so much more important. I don't remember. I've really struggled. I've actually experienced proper burnout when I was in my second year of my first undergrad. But then this time it was just sort of like I'd hit this wall where just like nothing was working. I was exhausted. I was actually at the brink of just giving up and just being like, fuck this.
It's not worth it.
But I was just, it's not worth it. But I think what I did was like, I was just like, you know what, Cynthia, at the end of the day, what matters is that you graduate as a doctor, because no one is going to ask you, did you graduate honors or not? People are just going to be like, oh, you're a doctor. Thank God. Can you just help me? You know what I mean? And it's just, again, just going back to the beginning of the conversation of like what actually matters to you. And I think also just talking about going back to Kenya, I think I had that same, because I was away for maybe as long as you were away for. But I think just looking back at people like Dennis and my other friends who'd gone back so soon after uni, at people who stayed back, and even looking at my brother now, like the community that they have. And I think this is why I'm not so keen on going back to Kenya so often, is because I didn't have the opportunity to go back as often. And so therefore I sort of, every time I go back home, I sort of feel like an imposter. I'm just sort of like, I know we're friends, but like we're not as close and I can't relate to so many things. Like the only reason I know fuel is 200 bob per liter now is because of my family group chat. It's not like I'm tuned in and whatever's going home back home. So I think I definitely understand. And I'm really glad to hear that there is a community of people who recognize that actually coming back from abroad, and then you are right, like I've never thought about it like that, but you are becoming an adult in Nairobi, which is hard.
Yeah. It's hard.
Being an adult abroad, but like in Nairobi, where it's already so tense. And then I think especially as like a woman as well, where like life abroad was so different, and you have to start rethinking things like safety and what time am I out, and you know, just work dynamics are probably so different as well. But I think it's really brave what you did just moving back home. And just, I think it's really amazing for you to even hear that, to say that out loud, and for other people to hear it, that like, it is a struggle.
Yeah, no, there are two things you said there that I also think are really important. The first is on, you know, how you draw the line for yourself. I think that we have a lot of self-talk that we assign it to external parties. We say people will think, oh, this is important because, you know, this is the way it should be. And I think, you know, pushing yourself for honors is a great example. As an undergrad, I had this attitude of like, the only way I can criticize this institution is if I do super well here. So I also pushed, you know, to graduate with honors and like be involved in a million extracurriculars, so that when I say like, this wasn't a great environment, people don't think it's because I didn't thrive. You know, and so like I filled myself with this narrative that I needed the success in order to have the opinion, you know, and I think that that's really damaging and unhealthy. And we need to sort of say like, we are valuable in and of ourselves. We're valuable because we're, you know, humans who deserve to be happy and fulfilled and well-rounded. And to your point, like no one cares what your transcript looks like, you know, like I have not, aside from when I was applying to grad school, like I have not, you know, shown anyone my college grades. And then I think the other thing that you said that is super important is it is a struggle to move somewhere and build community. But I also think sometimes, especially if you moved abroad for school and then you stayed where you were for school and didn't move around a lot after that big first move, it can be easy to sort of equate the hardship with just moving back home. But I think having moved a few different places now, building community as an adult is really hard. And the older you get, the harder it gets. I mean, I see my best friends here once every 3 weeks. That's a lot, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, 20-year-old me who was like, oh, I'm at my bestie's house 3 nights a week. I just couldn't understand what that means. So I do think there's a way we should, like, I would encourage young Kenyans who are listening and thinking about, should I move home or not, just to sort of be clear-eyed about the fact that there are things that we can attach to the act of moving home that are just true of trying to navigate life as an adult. And it takes time, but just being patient with yourself and sort of saying, like, it probably takes 6 to 8 months to feel settled anywhere. And right now, I moved back from my master's 2 months ago. I really don't feel settled. And I was only gone for 2 years, and I'd been here for 4 years before that. But it really does feel like I'm rebuilding again.
100% agree with that. When I moved back, it took me a long time to actually feel settled back mm-hmm. in Kenya, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Back in a place mm-hmm. where you've grown up your whole life. So, you know, it's home.
Yeah.
But then you go it's for home. Those few mm-hmm. years, you come back, and it took me a while to actually feel like, okay,
mm-hmm.
this is home, mm-hmm. in quotes, you know? It's just yeah. that feeling of... I built another home mm-hmm. over there, experienced so mm-hmm. much, and you come back mm-hmm. and it doesn't feel like home, but it is home.
Mm.
So then
but it is home, yeah.
Rebuilding that is a challenge for sure.
Yeah. And I don't know about you, but I also try to remind myself moving back to the US. Like, I thought that would be an easier move than it was, but it was a really hard move, you know? Like, I had lived there for 5 years and I still had a ton of friends in the US. And in fact, I'd had friends who weren't my friends when I was an undergrad, but had since, like, you know, moved to that around the Stanford area or in California broadly, but it was still really hard. And the first 6 months in grad school were really lonely. So just like remembering moving is hard can sometimes yeah. help, like, you know, shrink the monster of it in our minds.
Exactly. And I think a lot of the times younger us, I'm pretty sure like 16-year-old us would be like, what the hell are they talking about? It's a science, right. You know, you're yeah. just like, because every time I talk to my dad, he's like, hey, you remember I was telling you guys life abroad in Ngumu? Hmm? I'm like, yes, it sucks.
Yeah, no. There's so many times I hate it so much. I think about things my parents did to me, and I'm like, I hate that you were right.
Exactly, yeah. And thinking about you then graduating uni, your first mm-hmm. degree from U of Chicago, and then moving back home to Kenya to start working, what was it like then finding a job that suited you and particularly your interests, even though yeah. you'd studied abroad? And was that sort of like what your dad, well, I guess what the thought behind going to a good university gives you good job prospects? Was that translatable?
Yeah, I mean, I find it a bit tricky to talk about this. I had a pretty atypical experience of moving back. So I worked in the US for a year. And when I made the decision to move back, I moved back with a job. Like, I started applying for jobs before I left the US. So by the time I had like my ticket, I was coming to a job. And so I think there's some pragmatic things in there that are probably useful advice for young. It would probably be useful advice for younger people. The first is just like really understand who your profile is appealing to. So my undergrad was in philosophy. And I knew that there were a lot of employers who just wouldn't understand like what skill sets I was bringing to the table with that undergraduate degree. So I was kind of targeting American organizations that hired a lot of generalists because they would, one, understand the sort of selling point of a liberal arts degree, and two, the prestige of UChicago would be more translatable there. UChicago is a weird school where it's a really good school, but it's not like, the brand is not Harvard, it's not Columbia, it's not Yale, right? And so I was sort of pretty narrowly targeted in the types of companies I was even considering or applying to. And I think the second thing, they can be a little, I feel like, especially people who grew up with a little bit more privilege, middle class, upper class, upper middle or wealthy in Kenya, can have a sort of like tense relationship with the idea of using your network, you know? Mm. So there's this sort of like, more critical perspective of like, oh, this person, you know, rode in on the coattails of mom and dad, and like that's why they're successful. But I think that can, like, make people count themselves out of the network that they can build themselves. So my parents have no idea what I do, don't know anyone in my professional world, so I've never had them as a support in building my career. But I have had a lot of support from mentors that I've cultivated over the years, from peers, from people who just sort of are like, you know what, I believe in you. And sometimes I've been confused about why they believe in me, but their encouragement has been really helpful. And so I'd really encourage people, like, if you see someone whose career path you admire, or like, if you're like, 5 years from now, I want to be in their position, like, reach out. People are so happy to help. And people love to talk about themselves. So once you get them really going, like, you can get a lot of peer mentorship or near peer mentorship. And I've just valued so deeply my friendships with slightly older people, like, not, you know, my parents' age or even my auntie's age, just like somewhere between 3 to 6 years older than me. So a really key type of mentorship. And I think people like that can be really helpful in helping you navigate your move back home. And it's what you guys are doing with this podcast too. You're like putting together people in a similar-ish life stage and very comparable experiences. And I think this should be a model and a lesson to a lot of people.
Yeah, 100%. I think I was actually just talking to my best friends about this, but I was just like, I think when I was younger, I think especially from a medical perspective, because that's the only career I've ever had, but you think that, oh, I just need to have X and Y on my, you know, degree or mm-hmm. my CV, and then apply for this job and boom, even if it's a perfect match, I'm going to get the job. But mm-hmm. it's so much easier to hire the devil that you know. And yeah. a lot of companies are, they'll advertise a job, but if they know someone who knows someone that they can yeah. count on, it's not yeah. them being, they're not deceiving anybody, but that's just how the game has always been.
Yeah.
And it's yeah. just so yeah. much easier. And I think, to be quite honest with you, from having worked for the past year and a bit, I think it's so much easier to you for you to just build a network and just approach through that network and get a job, because I yeah. think oftentimes they're not, you might find, and I think we had this discussion with one of our friends, Vaidehi, you might find that through your network, someone can create a role that fits you yeah. a lot better than yeah. you just applying the more traditional 100%. Route. Because on yeah. paper, it might say full time, this and this hours. But mm-hmm. if you know someone in that network, you might just be like, okay, actually, I have these interests. I think I can do yeah. this. And you might find they're a bit more flexible because they trust yeah. you and they know you, and they know yeah. that you can deliver, and they have to spend less time and resources on training you. And so yeah. I think it's not about, you're not deceiving anyone. I mean, definitely there's other ways that you can definitely yeah. deceive people. And it's definitely yeah. happened, paying money. Yeah. I mean, we know the whole Kenyan way, but yeah. there is nothing wrong with reaching into a network or trying to build a network or put yourself in a position where you get introduced into a network that's yeah. going to benefit you.
Yeah. And it's true everywhere in the world, right? And I think sometimes we can be a bit, there's a certain attitude, I think Kenyans especially have, it's true in a lot of East Africa, where we're very negative on our own country and the opportunities here. And yeah. we'll then say things like, oh, you need a network, as like a negative point for the yeah. whole country. But it's true everywhere in the world. And I think as we grow into leadership positions, what then becomes important is, like, we need to hold each other accountable to building diverse networks, so that the network effects don't mean that the same people get hired over and over and over again, and some people are permanently locked out of opportunities. So, like, you know, one of the things that's super important to me now, having gone through the process of finding the fancy schools and getting those stamps, is I really think it's important not to hire based on that alone, or like, and think about, like, what are non-traditional education backgrounds that might offer really unique perspectives and skills to my organization, and how do I plug into the right spaces to meet those people? It might require more effort, but I think the more diverse your network, one, the better your companies will do and the better your teams will do, but two, I think there's like a social justice element to it as well, and a social equity element, where we should really hold each other accountable to that.
Absolutely. So going back to networking and mentorship, actually, what advice would you give young people looking for mentors? And I ask mm-hmm. this because a lot of our listeners are young, and in their minds, they're of there are a lot of people in my head that I want to push, but I don't know how or what yeah. I should go into. What advice would you
yeah.
give?
Yeah. A few different things. I think the first is like, look at work first. You know, if you are already employed and have a professional network, it's really easy for people to sort of take an interest in cultivating your career because they see your potential and they see your output. And like, it's easier to sell to someone who has that perspective, the mentorship opportunity to someone who has that perspective than someone who doesn't. But, you know, there are one, lots of people who are either looking to pivot or, you know, aren't in sort of a company that supports that type of thing. I would say, first be really clear-eyed about why you want mentorship from a particular person. Either their career path is interesting to you and you'd want to emulate it, or they've made certain types of pivots that seem quite dramatic and you want to understand how to do that, or they're, you know, or whatever it might be, like just like some connection that, you know, there's a clear ask for what you're trying to learn from them. I think the second thing, and I've had people approach me for mentorship and not done this, and I get really frustrated. Make it easy for people to say yes to you. If you reach out to someone, you be the one sort of proactively trying to figure out how to schedule a time, follow up if you don't hear back from them, be very specific in your ask. Like, could you, you know, make 30 minutes for me this week? I want to talk about 1, 2, 3 things. Like, make it clear. Like, the less you make that person think about what they can do to help you, the better at the onset. Because people do want to help, but
agree.
People want to help, but if you make them do all the thinking of like trying to figure out, okay, now what's your background and what are you trying to do, and like, it's just not you, this is for you, and to like sort of take a sense of ownership over it. So I think those are the main things, and then I would sort of say the last one is, don't expect every mentorship relationship to look the same. So I've had some people who I've gotten mentor advice from that have been like more one-off touch points. Like maybe we're in touch a couple of times in a short span of time, and then we sort of lose touch and our careers go in divergent directions. But in that moment, they offered me really actionable and clear advice. But there'll be some people who will be with you at every step of your career. They'll be your go-to recommenders for lots of opportunities. They'll sort of think of you and connect you to other people in their network. And then there'll be people who are sort of somewhere in the middle where you might not have as extensive long conversations, but, you know, sometimes they'll remember, oh, this person's working on something and I just met someone who's doing a great thing similar to this, so you guys talk. So just be flexible to the fact that there's many different types of support that folks further in their career can give you. And just because not everyone will be your dedicated champion and advocate doesn't mean that you can't gain valuable mentorship from them.
And just thinking about it from the other perspective, for people who want to be mentors, because we do have people who are older, people who are, you know, also our age, who have had lots of opportunities, and they're thinking about how can I make myself approachable for a mentorship. I think lots of people have been on this podcast, have given out their information. How can they then put themselves in positions to give other people advice? Oh, just mentorship in general, even if it's a bit more in an informal type.
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. That's a really good question. And something I think about a lot too, because I want to do more mentorship than I do. I would say the first thing is make yourself visible. I've been getting that advice a lot as I try to fundraise. And it's not my natural disposition. Like, I don't like being the center of attention. I don't like being the story. But put yourself out there and people will reach out to you. Like, I posted on LinkedIn yesterday about my pilot for my nonprofit. And someone reached out to me and was like, I want to work for you for free. And I was like, that's amazing. You know, people will reach out when they are excited about what you have to offer. So if mentorship is something you're interested in doing, you know, practice thought leadership, like whether it's on Instagram or LinkedIn, like put your opinion out there so that people understand what value you could bring to a mentorship relationship. I have a friend who did this a few years ago, and I should actually ask her how it went, but you know, the other thing you could do is just be very structured about it and share like a calendar or a Calendly link publicly and say like, hey, I want to give career advice to early stage, you know, I don't know, consultants or product developers or whatever it is that might be your unique offering, sign up for 30 minutes, share it on your WhatsApp groups. Like, I'm happy to give this time for free. And it takes some time, like with every part of building your personal brand, it takes a while for you to sort of figure out the right balance of like, how much time do I want to give and what types of things are interesting and unique. But if you just keep putting yourself out there, I think you'll find the opportunities. And then I think the last thing I'd say is like, be a mentor at work. There's so many people who aren't managers at work, and then they assume that that means they can't contribute to encouraging other folks in their careers. But there's so many ways people look at you that you don't even realize. And I've had folks I worked with years ago reach out in the last couple of years and say, you know, I always really admired how you did XYZ, and it's a surprise to me because it's stuff I didn't think anyone was seeing. But if someone asks for help on a type of skill or a project, like if you have the capacity to give that time, give it. And like, you don't have to have someone call you their mentor in order to give mentorship.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. I agree with that. I think society, especially the Kenyan culture, has put a title on mentorship of they have to be a manager or from a place of authority. So maybe that then spooks the person to the mentor to be like, I need to be very high up in the hierarchy to be a mentor. Yeah. Whereas like in my experience, in my second year of university, there was someone who came in from first year from Kenya as well. And he was just trying to figure out his way, like, how do you do this? How do you go here? And without me realizing it, I was actually his mentor, but I was just in second year. And, you know, it's a society where they put a title on mentorship being he has to be a manager, he has to be successful, he has to have everything sorted out, where it's a lot more than that than it actually people realize.
I completely agree with that. And sometimes, actually, the mentor who's so much more senior and advanced in their career can be really intimidating.
Yeah.
Like, it can be hard to understand how to get from where you are to where they are. And, you know, that goes back to, like, the thing earlier I said about people who are, like, you know, 5 years older than you. That's, like, an achievable step up. You know? Yeah. You can kind of understand the steps to get there. In a way that can be hard for someone who, you know, is like 50 years old and very established and well-regarded in their career.
Yeah, but I think it's also about believing in yourself and that what you have to say is actually worth something. I think that's something that, that question was for myself, but it's just trying to tell myself that I'm worthy enough, that what I have to say matters and like it's based on actual real experience, and my opinion does matter. And obviously, like you know, whenever someone gives you any sort of advice, even if it's someone that you know personally, it's not always going to be 100% translatable into your life. But that doesn't mean that what you have to say and what advice you have to give to someone who's either your junior, could be an age, or you know, just hierarchy perspective, doesn't mean that what you have to say isn't worth something. And again, I'm just saying to myself. But
no, I love the self-pep talk because I think it's such a good point. And also recognizing that peer mentorship is a thing, right? And so you might find that the relationship shifts back and forth with people more in your peer group, where like, I think the fact that you've set up this podcast is an incredible opportunity to mentor people on structuring their passions in a way that allows it to feed their community. And that is such a unique thing to have built and be able to like encourage other people to build. And sometimes we call it accountability, but I think there's a layer of peer mentorship in friendship as well, where you can really learn from the parts of your friends' lives that you admire. That's also an opportunity to be a mentor and receive mentorship.
100% agree. And you talked about a little bit about your new project and what exactly that you're up to with growing it. Because do you mind telling us a bit more?
Yeah, no, it's very brand new. And so this is sort of my spin at entrepreneurship, or like my attempt to, you know, take the risk with entrepreneurship. So I did my master's at Stanford, which is an extremely entrepreneurship obsessed school. And I think everyone who goes there kind of catches the bug. So I thought that, you know, this is a good time to sort of take the leap. I was already pretty unsettled and not making money because I was in grad school. So why not stay unsettled and not making money? And I got lucky. I got some grant funding from Stanford to launch my pilot. And so what we're doing right now is trying to figure out how can we create apprenticeship-based training programs and skills transfer programs to really get people from subsistence farming to sustainable commercial farming. And my background before grad school was working for development agencies, first in agriculture, then more broadly in rural development, where we were working with a lot of communities that, you know, increasingly there was a mix of resources available to them. They had access to better lines of credit, access to higher quality inputs. You know, there's still a long way to go, but increasing access to markets. But it's hard to bring all of those things together, even when you have the opportunity. And it's sort of like, why do you go to business school? Or why would you go to, you know, some other types of professional school to learn how to take these opportunities that are presented to you and package them in a way that allows you to sort of like make progress in your career? So it's sort of the same principle, like how do we equip agricultural workers with the skills and the mindsets they need to take the opportunities that are available to them and get to profitability and sustainable profitability. So right now we're running a pilot. It's a very small scale pilot. Let me correct myself. One of my mentors just told me a lot. Women do this a lot where we talk down our achievements even before we've made them, or we talk down the ambition of what we're doing. And so there's no need for me to call it a very small pilot. But we're working on a pilot now where we're enrolling a handful of farmers in a bespoke curriculum. So we start by going onto a farm and diagnosing the gaps in performance in a range of different ways. We look at biophysical characteristics, like how's their soil, how's their sort of water use, input use, etc. We look at the farm economics and how they're making decisions. And then we look at how they're managing staff, labor, etc. And so we make recommendations on ways to streamline that, whether it's sort of new technical methodologies that are more sustainable and translate to lower expenditure on inputs, or if it's just like thinking about cost controls or crop mixes in a way that allows you to maximize potential profit in the market. And then we just deliver that through a field trainer who's sort of on site on a regular cadence. So that's what we're doing. We hope to scale to be the gold standard for agricultural workforce development in the region. But there are a lot of steps between where we are now and there. But I'm really excited about the journey.
Just to add on to that, you will be the gold standard.
We will be. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
No, it sounds super, super interesting. And it is something that's necessary. It's something that farmers look for. And yeah, absolute best of luck with that. It sounds like such an amazing thing to start. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, no, I'm very excited about it. Every time I talk to somebody in agriculture, they're like, yes, I see exactly what you're aiming for. So I believe the market demand is there. And, you know, we just need to be tenacious about finding the right model to ensure that there is this sort of like robust agricultural workforce that makes, you know, like I think farming has this bad rep as like this last alternative for poor communities. But there's also literally so much wealth to be made, to be built in agriculture. And there, you know, countless millionaires who've gotten there from agriculture. And how do we sort of democratize access to that economic opportunity?
100%. I think Gadhoni's parents and my dad and my parents have recently just gone into farming, or like as they've reached that age, weirdly, because they didn't grow up as farmers. Maybe, you know, we all have some sort of relative who was a farmer, because again, like you've said, that's just where people start from. I think it's just natural as well as Africans to have someone in your family who was a farmer at some point, even if it's really small scale. But to see our parents sort of like reach that retirement age and just to turn back into farming says a lot about what farming can do. And even looking at here in the UK, every single, if there's no buildings, there's no houses, it's just farms.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just, I mean, at just the end of the day. Yeah.
At the end of the day, no matter what happens in the rest of the world, we need to eat. And sometimes, exactly. Because I'm so passionate about because I'm so passionate about food, sometimes I'm like, why isn't everyone working on this issue? You know? Why is this not the sort of like issue of the day? I completely agree. It is sort of a bedrock that I think is often overlooked, and I think is a huge opportunity from a climate angle, from a wealth and poverty reduction angle, to really accelerate agricultural progress.
And just thinking about the fact that you studied philosophy as an undergrad, and then in a graduate program you did an entrepreneurship, I'm assuming an MBA. Then what were the steps that essentially led you to being where you are now? Because I think it's a very big deal to go from you've been a generalist, you've gone into entrepreneurship, and now you're starting off this whole new project back home, giving back to people. So people who are interested, like you mentioned, in activism and social entrepreneurship, what were sort of the, what were the companies that you worked in? What are the skills that you had to build in order to get you to where you are now that you think would be essential for people? Because as we said before, it's not exactly something you get taught in university, and definitely not something you get taught in
China. So my master's is actually in environmental policy, but I did take a lot of classes in the business school. So sort of that's what whet my appetite around entrepreneurship. I would say the key thing is a learner's mindset. In building a career that's sort of more sector agnostic or sector flexible, you need to be willing to be bad at something for a little bit and gain the sort of sector specific knowledge, but also understand how your skills can be leveraged in different contexts. So for other generalists like me, having strong communication skills and being an effective project manager seem like sort of unremarkable skills, but when you are in environments where those skills are missing, you sort of realize how critical they are. And so I would encourage generalists to bring sort of that toolbox to the table, to really be proud of that toolbox and see its value, and then be willing to learn the content. So over the years, my first job in Kenya was at One Acre Fund, which is a large social enterprise working with smallholder farmers across sub-Saharan Africa. And then my second job was with GiveDirectly, which is another very large nonprofit. They do direct cash transfers. Both, I would say, are like, I like to say that I worked with the sort of top tier of development organizations in the region, in terms of scale, impact delivered, and just the talent pools they attract. And I think in both roles, I had both organizations, multiple roles, I had the privilege of working with some of the smartest, most dedicated, and kindest professionals I've had the opportunity to work with. And it really taught me that if you're willing to learn and be humble about what you don't know, and be creative about applying your skills to different types of problems, you'll have a lot of career flexibility. I think in the course of that, I discovered a genuine and true passion for food and agriculture. And I think a lot of generalists do stumble upon a subject matter that sort of ignites something a bit brighter than other things. Mm-hmm. But it's sort of just being patient that might take time. And it's okay to be working on something that you think is interesting and, you know, is feeding your intellectual curiosity, is feeding your thirst for impact or whatever it is that drives you, even if it's not like, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life for sure. So I just encourage people to take that mindset as well. And you'll be surprised by how many doors are open up by sort of just saying like, I'm willing to learn and I'm sort of humble about where that learning opportunity comes from.
Well spoken. Like me on as a host, I'm learning as well.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it goes back to what you're saying, being open to learn.
It's just a mindset thing. Yeah. And people, like, because I think there are things you can't train and there are things you can train. And I think if you get good at learning, there are very few things that I think you can't pick up along the way. But I think it's harder to train the sort of attitude, like, I want to learn and I'm hungry for knowledge and, you know, I'm willing to be bad at things for a little bit and eventually get good.
All right.
And yeah, I think I'm all questioned out.
Yeah, right.
Oh, this is great. You guys are fantastic. And I so admire what you're doing with this platform. I think it's so important to build community and allow us to learn from each other. So thank you for doing this.
100%. And thank you for being on the podcast as well. We haven't had someone in this sector, which is why we're happy, because I know many of our listeners have been in very many industries or sectors that they're just waiting to hear, you know, someone who can talk about it in this sort of scale, this sort of avenue that you have. So great knowledge, great insights. Thank you for being that person who can give a lot of information for those people looking for it.
Of course, yeah. And I really am happy to connect with folks who are interested in building careers in the nonprofit space or in the social impact space. You know, I know that everyone puts that out. but I genuinely do love to talk to young people who are excited about community transformation. So I'm happy to have folks reach out to me on LinkedIn or I know there's a sort of like usual, where can people find you?
That was my next question.
So on LinkedIn, I'm Shira Washira. I think that's probably the best place. Work-wise, connect with me. And then Growing Acres, which is my social enterprise, where growingacresinstitute.org. So connect and I'd love to hear from young folks passionate about transformation.
And I think as someone who has known Shira for a long time, I would say that she's a great person to know. She's very, very lovely, very kind, always been very sweet. And I'm really, really thank you for just making the time to be here. It's been a back and forth of trying to figure out the right time.
What, like March or April? So thank you for being patient.
It's been a while, but she's made the time. We're really, really, really grateful. And we can't wait to have you back on. I'm pretty sure this is not going to be the last interview that you ever do. And we're just very excited to be the first one, hopefully, to have had Growing Acres CEO on the podcast. I'm really excited to see what you do. So thank you so much for making the time. And we're very excited to have you guys back on for another episode very soon. So connect with us on Instagram, share and like this podcast on Spotify, or really listen to your podcasts. And we'll catch you guys on the next one. And take care. Bye.
Thank you for tuning into another episode of A Kenyan's Experience. If you found this episode inspiring or even helpful, then please do us a solid and share it with close friends or family, or even just share it to the world. We appreciate you. Hit us up. Check out that new feature, the voice notes. Let us know what you think about this episode. We'd love to hear back from you.